welcome to another holiday edition of the Streaky Alone podcast. I hope everyone listening had a wonderful holiday and got all the good stuff that they wanted and are ready for some football. And so to do all the things that are football related and talk about them, I have my good friend Paul here with me today. Paul, how are you?
Hello, how are you?
Good. Oh, and this is Caroline. For those of you that haven't picked that up yet, Pierce is not here.
Oh, I was so confused.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Ooh, got that out of the way. But yeah, it's there's one more football game left this year, Paul, and it's on Saturday at noon, and it's the only important football game that's on Saturday.
Clearly the most important.
Absolutely. Like, y'all can keep your, you know.
It is the Belk Bowl finals, so I don't want the semifinals nonsense.
That's very true. That's a good point.
The only game being played in Charlotte.
And good news is that the weather's supposed to be, knock on wood, delightful. So unlike the First Responder Bowl, there's probably a pretty good chance that it won't get canceled. Which, let's just talk about that real quick. The bowl season to start has been a little bit crazy. I don't really care about anything that happened on the field too much, but have you ever, I mean, there haven't really been any instances of a bowl being canceled.
No, it's absolutely not. Like, you would always expect it of, like, the Bahamas Bowl or one of those games that's played on, like, you know, an intramural soccer field behind a Walmart somewhere. But, like, this is the Cotton Bowl. Like, it's not at Jerry. Yeah. It's at the old Cotton Bowl. But still, it's like, figure something out. Like,
I'm pretty surprised that they had – well, there was also, like, thunderstorm warnings. So, for people listening that may not – there's a lot of stuff on Twitter and it's going around. It's like, why don't they just play it the next day? And it's the same thing that we talked about a little bit with all the moving parts for when games during the regular season are being canceled for hurricane stuff. The moving of a football game, especially a bowl game, logistically is a nightmare. In order, you know, that's now we're talking, because that was a 1:15 game. So I guarantee you that all, like, the teams had planned on leaving that afternoon, like, after the game. So now we've got to find hundreds of hotel rooms in the Dallas, greater Dallas area, with the national semifinals going on, like, also in Dallas. So, like, there's a lot of moving pieces. So I get why they can't just be like, oh, we'll just meet you here tomorrow at 9 a.m. and we'll play it then. But holy shit, the game was canceled.
I'm not sure that, like, they necessarily would have left that day, because, like, it's a 1:15 game, it's a bowl game, so factor in TV and all that kind of stuff, you're still running until, like, 5 o'clock at least. Then you've got a couple hours for post game, and then you've got to get back to Boise and Boston. So, like, but that doesn't so, like, playing the like, could they have stayed an extra night? Maybe, I don't know. But it does seem like it is. It seems like the only thing that happens for regular season games is they'll just keep pushing it back. It's like, oh, we've got a 3-hour weather delay. Okay,
yeah, well,
that's fine. Virginia and BYU did that a couple years ago. I wonder how much the TV slot.
Yeah, I think ESPN owns the bowl.
Yeah, so I guess I don't. Yeah, it would be. I would watch a 30 for 30 soul.
Yeah,
maybe like
for
maybe
sure.
Like a 15 for 15. Like, not a full 30. Just. So I want, like, I want, you know, a good long form on what happened. Yeah.
They can do the second 15 minutes on the Cheez-It Bowl that had interceptions.
I completely missed that and then woke up this morning and, like, started checking my college football Twitter that had apparently all tuned into the game at halftime.
Yeah.
It was, like, three different sport writers were, like, I took bad beats on having bet 0 combined points for the third quarter. And then there was the touchdown that got overturned and then overturned again right at the end of the third quarter with like 20 seconds left. I mean, it's nuts. I it's my new favorite bowl game because the trophy is a bowl of Cheez-Its.
Yes.
Which, okay.
Amazing.
Fantastic. I wonder, is it like, do we think it's an assortment? Is it like the pepper jack and
oh, it better, it just, like, did you know, so I read yesterday on Twitter, this is what I love about bowls. I am pro have as many bowls as it's physically possible.
Oh, yeah.
Because you get stuff like this, and like, I engaged only on Twitter basically for this game because, you know, it was like later, and it was phenomenal to follow, and the jokes were great. They called it, like, I saw a couple, like, the cheese ints. IMTs.
Nine interceptions.
Yeah. At one point, the TCU quarterback, I think, had 3 interceptions and 4 completions.
Nice.
There was an interception that he threw after he got the ball thrown back to him beyond the line.
So there was, that was my favorite. That was my favorite little stat tidbit. There was a play that had both a completed pass and an interception.
Yes, that's my favorite. And then, like, I learned there's 16 different flavors of Cheez-Its.
Seems which, low.
Oh, see, I was like, aren't there like four?
Like, no, see, well, there's big.
Cheesy. Does that count as a flavor, though? Is that a flavor? Are we
variety. It's, okay. a variety.
Yeah.
So we've got big. Do you know what the best Cheez-It is?
The regular ones.
Multigrain. Because one, because they taste almost exactly like the regular, and two, I can convince myself that they're healthy because it's whole.
Man, what a great bowl. First of all, and I saw someone else point this out, but their logo is fantastic. Like, it's played in Arizona, and they incorporated the whole of the Cheez-It as the sun, like the Arizona flag. Like, that's great. That's brilliant. Yeah. And you get a bowl. Like, it's just a bowl, which looks nice. It's like a crystal bowl on top of a trophy. So it's not just like they handed you, like, a plastic bowl that you make popcorn in. Though.
Cool Whip holiday tub.
Yeah, exactly. It previously held muddy, like the Muddy Buddies, whatever, right. For a party. But yeah, it was full of, and now the players got boxes of Cheez-Its like right after the game.
Yeah, those definitely survived the bus ride back to the hotel.
The walk to the locker room. Like, so there's these great pictures of like the DCU Horned Frog mascot holding like a box of Cheez-Its, and he was stealing Cheez-Its out of the trophy. Like, this is why
do we think he could eat the Cheez-Its through the mask?
He'd have to probably stick, I don't know what you mean, it's a real horned frog.
That's Paul. True. It is a true-to-life anatomically correct giant horned frog.
Animatronic
horned can shoot frog. Actual blood out of it.
Gross. I forgot they can do that. So,
Favorite thing about that mascot.
Bowl season is amazing, and I love it. And so it's almost Virginia's turn. Virginia plays at noon on Saturday. And so right now they're doing all the fun bowl week stuff. This is what I love and what's important about bowl week, not so much like the actual game. I mean, the game's obviously important and the most important part, but this is what people have talked about with even making a bowl, depending on what the stature of said bowl is important because you, one, get more practice, and two, this is fun for the guys, like, and their families and the, you know, everyone who's involved, because they went to the Charlotte Motor Speedway yesterday. Did you see any of this stuff, Paul?
I did. It's the
going 160 most miles.
Charlotte thing you can do is go do NASCAR stuff.
Yeah, it was great. Like, they got, apparently Alameda was like not planning on going in the race car at 160 miles an hour, and then he was like, "YOLO!" Like, literally said, "You only live once." I know. but I love that stuff. And they went to the NASCAR Hall of Fame and we're doing like competitions changing tires and
I have to admit I don't know how much a bunch of guys from like, you know, Chesapeake and Virginia Beach are like, oh yeah, NASCAR, that's been a prominent part of my conscious sports watching experience my entire life.
I mean, I'm curious to see how much the coaching staff has been like remotely involved. Yeah, no, in that's watching fair. Any. Yeah,
big thing in Utah. All of the
Coach Menonall, big NASCAR fan. but it looked like they had any. I think any time that you let the guys compete, they're going to be super into it.
Oh yeah.
And so that was definitely part of it. And then today they were.
They did like a pit crew competition.
Yeah, pit crew competition.
Change. I thought it was like 9 seconds, which is not like
that's pretty good. You know,
it's not lit. I'm sure I've just made fun of not watching NASCAR. And I'm like, 9 seconds. What are you, trapped in mud? Like,
so, and that's not even. Probably faster. They didn't have to take the full tire off. They just like take it off and then put it right back on and then whatever. I'd want to be the person that does the fuel because that looked like the easiest thing.
Notice they gave that to the backup punter or backup kicker, backup punter Pearson.
Well, and also like a lot of times it was like the bigger lineman. Like,
exactly. Throw two linemen on the jack.
Yeah, exactly.
Running back on the lug nut gun and then just put a punter.
and it looked like today they were doing they went to the food bank and packed some bags, which is great. Obviously these always have a charitable arm.
Shout out to the guys for having done that before they left Charlottesville too.
Yes, also true.
I know the defensive backs did sort of a like community Secret Santa thing. I don't know. I don't remember if there were other position groups that were involved also, but I had a coach Atawaya, running backs coach, giving them a big shout out on Twitter for it.
Which is awesome. Like, it's really nice to see. And it, makes I mean, it a lot of, yeah. And that's so, so true. And it also like, it seems like there's been enough time for people to get healthy, which is going to be a big key. this game is interesting. I will fully admit not to have watched a lot of South Carolina this season. No. Just not real high on the list of.
Yeah, those like mid-tier SEC East teams.
So yeah. But the big, I think when looking at first glance and see what you think on this is that their passing game is going to be the biggest test. And when I look at it, thankfully, the one of the units that I'm still the most comfortable with Virginia is the secondary. So Paul, when you look at that matchup, like you got Jake Bentley, they're obviously missing Deebo Samuels, who is sitting out to prepare for the draft. But that doesn't mean they don't have competent receivers behind him. When you look at that matchup, how do you feel about it looking at it, and what else concerns you or interests you matchup wise in this game?
Well, I think that, I mean, the thing that's the most surprising to me is looking at a Will Muschamp coached team that has just a not good defense. I mean, just not fantastic. That you would expect, you know, they're looking, I'm looking at their stat profile from Bill Connolly, and they're 29th in offensive S&P and then 61st in defensive. And that's just, you know, that total switch from what you'd expect from, you know, Coach Boom. But I agree with you that given that it's another sort of strength on strength matchup that we've seen a couple of times this year, I feel like, with this Virginia team, that the defensive backs, Virginia's strength, wide receiving core, South Carolina's strength, and just kind of running down their roster, they've got some big wide receivers. They've got a couple of guys that are 5'10", you know, Shai Smith and Josh Van, both kind of not all the way, you know, small down to like slot receiver size, but not, you know, sort of average power five kind of speedy wide receivers. But then Brian Edwards is 6'3", 220. Yeah. And with Deebo Samuel out, he's by far the leader in targets for that South Carolina unit. He's got Deebo had 97 targets for the year and 62 catches. Edwards had 85 with 52 catches, and then Shai Smith was third with 56. So you start seeing a pretty sharp drop off after the top two. And with Deebo out, I mean, I would, if I'm them, I'm trying to hammer the ball into Edwards.
Yeah.
That'll be a good test. I mean, you've got a guy like Bryce Hall that's good sized, everything. All, as he's starting to get more draft hype, there's a lot of talk about his size being a big part of what makes him such an intriguing draft prospect. And he'll have his hands full. You know, I think him and Juan Thornhill should, you know, between the two of them can probably sort of trade off that sort of size matchup. And then, I mean, that's the good thing is that UVA has been trying to fill its defensive backfield with big guys like that. Tim Harris is no shrinking violet. And the thing that will be interesting to me is whether UVA tries to use its depth a little bit this game. You've got a bunch of guys that have played in 1, 2, 0, 1, 2, or 3 games this year. And with the new redshirt rule, that means this is their chance to actually see some action without burning a redshirt.
Yeah.
So you've got a guy like Jalen Baker that's a, you know, 6'2", 6'3", defensive back that's been on this roster and hadn't seen the field much. Like, do you maybe give him a run? Maybe it's just for a series, not to start, you know, maybe not in the second half, but like a second quarter series against a big wide receiver like that. Try and see whether guys can play some roles. So I think that's kind of like a hidden storyline that I think could be interesting is whether it's decent guys we're not used to.
And I'm looking at what I like about, you look at their receiving core, and like you said, Deebo Samuel, obviously super talented, the guy to go to, 11 touchdowns. Brian Edwards with 7 touchdown receptions on the season. And they've got a pretty fair amount of like spreading the wealth. But I like that's something that what Virginia does is it makes it difficult to guard, as you've got Joe Reed with 7 touchdown receptions, Olamide with 6, Cassis with 5, who have had some injuries down the stretch here. So I'm curious to see how available Cassis Dubois is. But I'm just curious, I don't know what to expect of this game. You know, maybe it's because there's been a couple weeks off and we've been in full basketball mode. I've been in full basketball mode. But I'm curious, and maybe part of it is like, you know, they looked great to start the game last year. But
ended the game after UVA's opening kickoff return.
Exactly. And then talk about a time to have a first responder bowl incident. Would have been great last year.
Yeah.
Too cold. Everyone go home. Virginia wins.
Unfortunately, last year's bowl game also ended in a no contest.
That's so true. I don't know. I feel like this is a good matchup in the sense that they get a chance to play against a middling SEC team. Not middling. I'm not trying to, like, give anyone.
Yeah, no, but it's it, they yeah. are. They're middle of the pack in what is still arguably the strongest conference in the country.
Yeah. Well, they certainly think so.
They're 7-5. We're 7. Yeah, Virginia's 7-5.
They've had similar seasons. I think that's why I'm curious to see how it plays out, is because they have had several games that were decided by a score or closely contested, and Virginia clearly has had the same thing. I've seen maybe there's some lack of enthusiasm going down the stretch with the way the last couple games ended, but you can't deny that Virginia was in every single game that they played this year.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's what, I mean, that's a good step for a growing or developing team, you know?
Yeah.
To be competitive against every single team you play is really a baseline of all you could ask for going forward. I agree. So I think that's the part that I'm most curious about, see how they come out and see. I mean, it's just, I'm just excited to watch Bryce Perkins play again, if we're being honest. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm actually interested to see whether the series thing, I think the alternating series that I was kind of talking about, Brennan Armstrong is actually the most interesting, whether they try and use him, because he's played in three games, so he's got one more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be an interesting way to, like, I don't know, I'm intrigued to see how the game plays out from a personnel management standpoint, which is one of the nerdiest things I've ever said. But seeing whether the coaches are really leaning into, we've got to keep our best 11 on the field every moment, because winning this game is really important to us. And I would be okay with that approach. Let me be clear. Like, I, having not beaten Tech this year, the other easily measurable yardstick
is
not just the number of wins, but also then winning the bowl game.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's as much emphasis as there has been on increase the profile of raise the profile of the program, show measurable success, measurable progress. I would not be at all surprised if they're really leaning hard into the win the bowl game, because it puts another, you know, gets them to 8 wins. I mean, that's
That's huge. I agree. I think that would take some, I mean, definitely that sting from the Tech game lasts for a while, but it takes some of that off with, like, it's easier to call this a successful season. And I hate saying that, like, in a way that sounds like it wasn't otherwise, when I think that they outperformed and obviously outperformed expectations. They were picked to finish last in the ACC, and until 2 weeks left in the season, they were still in contention technically for the ACC Coastal. So, but yeah, I think putting a statement win over an SEC team would 100% be a really, really nice touch to the end of the season. Show exactly what you're talking about, that development, that growth, that I'm excited. But at the same time, I say that I have very little, like, stress or anxiety about this game. I don't know. Is that weird? I don't know.
Maybe yeah, I mean, it's kind of
much, but
I've said that before. I've said that before on the podcast. Of, like, leading into the Georgia Tech game, I was like, meh, whatever.
Yeah,
the game goes to overtime, and I'm pulling my hair out. So
yeah.
It's like I don't. It's not that I don't care. I do. There is sort of a zen, like, okay, look, it's been a good season. It can be a better season.
Yeah.
And of course, once kickoff comes, I'll be, just
cursing everything South Carolina down my
throat, trying to stop the jitters.
Well, we already got that one dub over basketball.
Yeah, exactly. As I said, I would take another 17-point win over South Carolina. I'd be a
for big sure
fan of that.
So, what do you think happens? How does this game play out for you?
I think going back through some of their stats, I had not realized that Debo was also their primary kick returner. So their kick return unit is one of the best in the country. They're top 12 on the kickoff efficiency, kickoff return efficiency. But of their 31 kick returns this year, Debo's got 23 of them.
Oh.
And the two guys behind him have not been any you've got one guy with 3 fair catches who I think is a tight end. And then, a guy averaging about 5 yards a return less than Debo's. AJ Turner is their sort of second biggest return guy. So that's actually, I think, when you've got a UVA, the offensive and defensive S&P ranks pretty much match each other. The South Carolina's offense is 29th. Virginia's in the mid-20s on defense. Uh-huh. And it's sort of low 60s for both South Carolina defense, Virginia offense. And we talked about unit by unit, there's pretty good matchup. So that kind of opens the door of like, well, then special teams ought to be the difference maker. South Carolina's rated very well on special teams. It has still been, even as it has improved with Brian Delaney as kicker, it has still been kind of the weak point for Virginia. But now a big part of why they're that good is not playing. So there's the two things that I continue to be the most concerned about are the other elements of South Carolina's special teams game are still really good. They've got a really good kicker. But the strength of their defensive line, I see it. It feels like it's setting up to be kind of like an NC State, matchup that it's just there. Virginia can probably match them speed for speed on the outside. And I think can game plan well with them, but there's just, it's an SEC defensive line. They've had solid, very solid recruiting classes the last couple of years. Yeah, it's not like playing Clemson's defensive line, but it's still a very solid defensive front that gave Virginia so much trouble against NC State.
If
Virginia can hold its own up front there, I feel like it's much – if Virginia can even neutralize South Carolina's defensive front, then it becomes a much better game for Virginia.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Line play is just always going to be until maybe like not next season, but the next season. I feel like I'll be more comfortable with.
Yeah. Where depending on what happens with transfers or anything like that.
Yeah. So I'm looking at it and I'm like, all right, I just want to see some solid play calling offensively. That's such a small, and I just want it to be like, this is what I always complain about when people say like, this basketball team's going to lose 5 games, and that's okay. And then they lose 5 games because they don't play well. And then everyone's like, I can't believe they did this, and this wrong. Like, just be competitive, and I'll be happy. I think they have a good shot at it. I think it'll be close. I think it'll be a one-score win either way, whomever. But I want to go Virginia wins this one. I got to stay positive. What about you, Paul?
Nice. Why not? I don't know. Yeah, I mean, like, ESPN's predicting about a 5 or 6 point South Carolina win. It's about what the line is. I think it's 5.5 as of, Thursday morning. But Bill Connolly's, he's projecting about 3 points in South Carolina's favor. So, single score in either direction sounds about right. I'll go 4-point Virginia win. Weird touchdown at the end. Why not?
Cool. So we'll just transition quickly into some basketball. Virginia 11-0, one of 5 remaining undefeated teams. Pretty convincing win over William & Mary, 72-40. Not really ever in doubt. The only real bright spot for William & Mary in that game was my new dude, Nate Knight. It was unbelievable. So there's been some talk about the schedule and is this team prepared for conference play? They still have one more non-con against Marshall on New Year's Eve. Paul, you were at that game on whatever day that was, Saturday. What's your take? Like, are you confident this team's ready to go in the ACC play? They obviously start with number 9, Florida State, in Charlottesville. So luckily not a road trip to Florida where historically – except the last couple of years, historically, Virginia hasn't done very well, so that's good at least. What's your take on the team? Are you concerned? Are you?
Look, I am less concerned. DeAndre showed up.
Yes.
Like whoa, against William & Mary, 18 points, 9 of them from the line. And what I like about that is that it's showing not just a willingness, but an ability to go to the hole, get, draw the contact. Mm-hmm. And kind of spark an offensive night that way, and not just an offensive night. Hopefully, it's sort of sparking DeAndre, just the just seeing him go through kind of mentality. I would have liked to see more off the bench play, going a little bit deeper against a team like William & Mary. The fact that with a 20-point lead,
pretty late in the game that I would have liked to see Huff and Anthony and maybe Bidoki, who got his college debut,
which is
I would have liked to see them play maybe from the under four all the way to the end of the game.
Yeah.
Instead of just mop up in the last 90 seconds. It's just a little bit surprising to have not seen that. And it does make me concerned of if we get into conference play, if we get into, all the bigs get in foul trouble and Huff's got to go. Is he going to put Huff in, or is he going to go with some weird five guard lineup that DeAndre's playing center?
Unfortunately, I think it's more the latter. And I say that unfortunately-wise, I don't know. Jay Huff is, I still think, going to be a really good player for Virginia. A lot of people think that time is come and gone, and it's like he's done, and he's not playing now. When is he ever going to play? I think we've talked about this before, just like it takes time in the system for big men to develop, and there's just stuff that he's not. I think it's clear he comes in and drills a three, and everyone loses their mind, and it's awesome. And then he gets taken to town very easily by Knight down low on back-to-back plays. Like, and that to Tony is why he's not in. Like, should he have stayed in a little longer or come in earlier, later in the game? Sure. I don't know why. Like, obviously, we don't have any insight why he's playing the people when he's playing them. But there's also been debates previous seasons that he didn't do enough to establish the shorter rotation. So it's kind of like, where do you stop tinkering in the non-con and let guys that are going to be playing significant amount of times together in the ACC play gel better and get more used to each other? I don't know which is right, which is wrong. But it's a good point because clearly Anthony Marco comes in for defensive abilities.
Right.
And not saying that he has a very Malcolm-esque flat shot at this point. I just always want to compare him to Malcolm because he's built just like Malcolm. When you talk to him, like you're talking to a physical, like, replica of Malcolm Brogdon. And he came in at Maryland and he was absolutely influential immediately. Like, Virginia could not get a stop at Maryland in the first half. He came in and they got several back to back. Then it's kind of like, what do you give up on the other end? Obviously, Clark is still a little bit rusty with the whole, regrowing a bone thing that he's doing.
Yeah. That takes some time.
Yeah, weird. To your point on the free throw shooting, one, I love that they've been going to, like, getting to the line more, like, and putting themselves there. And as a team, they're shooting 77%, which is
not bad.
Really good, especially when you consider free throws. Everyone back off. Jay's is low too. Jay's at 43% and Jack's at 47%. But including those, so you look at the guys that are going to the line the most, and Dre is shooting 83%. Ty's is 74%. We should talk.
Which is weird, because I thought Ty was like a 90% free throw shooter in here.
It'll probably get back up there. Kyle's at 85. Mamadi 88. That's awesome.
Wow.
Braxton is up there at 78. So like he's getting, and he hasn't gotten as much. So he's 18 for 23. So like that's really good too. And I think he's shown a little bit more in the past couple games, and Mamadi has really taken advantage of starting the last two games.
I agree.
He was outstanding. That was nice to see against William Mary.
I will say my concern on the Huff issue does have a little bit more of a longer time horizon in terms of impact than just this season. That say Huff gets frustrated at Tony not trusting him and not playing him and leaves. Which I don't think would be beyond the pale for a former four-star, highly heralded, obviously offensive talented player to go, nope, I'm not going through this anymore. I think there becomes a legitimate question about big men developing under Bennett.
I don't know that I agree there.
I if nothing else, it becomes a fairly obvious negative recruiting opportunity for anybody else. Unless Casey Shedrick comes in and, like, by all accounts, Casey Shedrick is what I think we've actually talked about this. That he's the best defensive recruit that Bennett's got.
There was a clip on Twitter the other day. I was like, what?
Yeah. So, yeah. Like, there is the possibility that, you know, Shedrick is next year's Kihei Clark, but a foot and a half taller. And then this is a moot point, that it's a big man who's playing early and playing frequently. But even Mamadi was a high four-star.
Mamadi didn't play basketball until he was in high school.
Right. No, but he then had to sit, like, I get what Jack brings to the team. Jack is a contributor to what this team does and tries to do. But people who watch Virginia basketball casually, even serious basketball people, if you told them that you had, you know, a 6 foot eight, a 6'9" bouncy four star and a 7-footer who can shoot the three, and both of them sat behind Jack Salt for the last year and a half, they would think you're crazy.
I want to put all of this blame, and I think a lot of this perception on it comes from Austin Nichols. And here's why. Because he really did screw up some stuff when it came to not just his own personal life stuff, but this team development and progression. Because
succession planning.
Yes, because there was supposed to be an All-American caliber center playing for this team for 2 years, right? So when he decided not to do what he needed to do, like, that changed. Now Jack is the guy. Jack was never supposed to be the guy. Like, he would tell you that as much. Like, he's not, like, that wasn't, this is all still, and so that gap, like, the look at the big men that Tony has had and has developed that have come up, and there's been a succession plan.
But there has there been a true big? Like,
I mean, Akil Mitchell and Darion.
But they're like 6'8", 6'9". I'm talking.
But basketball is going away from the true big.
No, but it's not. It's not going. I don't think it's going
Jay
away.
Jay is not a true big. He's a stretch four.
I literally mean size big. I literally mean somebody who is that 6'11" and up that can stretch the floor. And now UVA's got one, and they aren't using it. Yeah, I agree that, like, positionless basketball is coming.
He's a year into it. I just think, like, I don't think he's going to I mean, anything could happen, but, like, from what I've heard and, like, his actual interests and what he's a part of at UVA goes more beyond basketball.
Okay. But
in the sense that, like, he's part of different groups and he's in a community and, like, but obviously anything could happen. He could get frustrated.
Yeah.
I think because he redshirted, there's, like, a, it seems like he's been here longer than he has, and or at least playing wise.
He's a redshirt sophomore, correct?
Yes, he's 11 games into his second season. So, and then people say, like, oh, so is Dre. But comparing development between the two positions is tough. Like, that's really hard to do. Like, it's a lot easier to get in the game and start. I don't, like, if you look at Jay, like, do you think he's physically ready to be part of a deep, like, he's
thin.
He's skinny. But
he's not. I mean, he. I don't know.
He ordered three bagel sandwiches.
He's a legit shot blocker.
Yeah. I just need him to close out with his hands up, and I will change my tune on a lot of things.
But he blocked a 3-point attempt at some point this
because season. He probably closed out with his hands up.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't need him coming in with his hands down his waist.
It'll be interesting to see whether some of the offensive change that people like me have been clamoring for the last couple of years. Whether, to your point about, like, Nichols leaving, screwing up a bunch of the plans.
That was just a huge chunk in the middle that is still fresh in people's minds. So you think, like, we haven't had a good big man since Anthony Gill, and we were supposed to have a good big man. Nichols.
Yeah.
For 2 years, that helps succession. You know what I mean?
And I get that. But I'm wondering whether next year, once Jack leaves and the available players in that sort of big range are Braxton Key, Mamadi Diakite, Jay Huff, Shedrick, you know, potentially ready if he's
Cafaro.
Cafaro coming off of a redshirt, you know, you can play a little bit more up tempo, a little bit more positionless. You've got guys that can, you know, no, I'm not gonna necessarily trust Cafaro to shoot the three all that, like, but like, no, you've got what, Cafaro's 7 foot 7'1", Huff's 7 foot 7'1". You've got a couple of guys that are a little bit more nimble, a little bit more agile. It'd be interesting to see whether the sort of the blocker mover, which relies on sort of traditionally defined roles, becomes a little bit less the only thing they run. If they try and do a little bit more, I mean, you know, the when Jack has contributed the most on offense this year, it's been in pick and roll game kind of.
Yeah. And I was going to say they've added a bunch of different wrinkles too.
Yeah.
I think they've added more this year than I think if you've only watched, and I'm not, this is not you. If the mass that continued want to say like, oh, Virginia's boring, have only watched a couple games, you might not have seen some of the having, like we've talked about before, having Guy and Ty being able to run off ball combined with Jack screens, combined with Kihei being the salt whisperer and using him on pick and rolls, has definitely changed up what the offense can do. Where they run into problems is if too many of those are out of the game and they don't necessarily know. There's still been situations where they've had a lot of standing around, which right. is what makes me nervous.
The other, yes, they've changed, but when they need, when the offense is struggling, they don't go to something different. It seemed like it always reverts back to run the blocker mover better.
Or drive the lane, which I think they've done a lot better this year.
That's fair. But
maybe off of the blocker mover like, setup. But.
It feels like there's a, you know, if it's been 2 minutes without getting a bucket, if it's, you know, the I don't know, it feels like the default is, it isn't try something different to exploit a matchup. It's go back to what we do best. And I get it. I understand. but it feels like if what you do best hasn't been working, don't just try to do it better. Like
I do think against William & Mary, like the last 7-8 minutes of the first half were not good. A lot of turnovers,
no, really ugly.
Some bad shots, and then Knight was able to get some stuff on offense, and that's when they like made a little bit of a run. However, during that, they did seem to try new things, which I was like, I like the idea, but maybe don't try and do a nifty pass, which goes right to a guy in the middle, and then they get a run out basket. So it's kind of like maybe, and if you're going to try stuff, now's the time to do it, or then was the time to do it. Like, when you're, and again, at no point where things felt different that so far this season is like, at no point has, I want to say in like really any of the games, which feels like a lie now because I'm always nervous, but like at no point, like against Maryland, against Wisconsin, even with William & Mary getting within 6 points to start the second half, was I like, oh no, here we go. Like, this is it. They're going to lose. Like, they're going to blow it. Like, people have stepped up and taken a big shot or hit a big shot or, Ty is just ridiculous. I don't like he needs to stop because he's like starting to make top 30s and shit. And I can't, if him and Dre leave the same, I can't deal. But yeah, I'm going to go on my little scheduling rant. Scheduling is done anywhere from like 3 months to 2 years out, right? And coaches do the best that they can to set up a challenging non-conference that isn't going to destroy their team, that's going to prepare them. And that if you're not an ACC or Big Ten school, maybe sometimes SEC depending on the year or Big East depending on the year, Virginia doesn't necessarily need this year. They don't need a non-conference to make a tournament. The teams that need to schedule crazy non-conference are Gonzaga or Nevada or whatever, that need these games to say like, hey, look, we play in the Mountain West, but we can hang out and do well against these other teams, right? So everyone wants to see the Villanovas and the West Virginias, and those are fun. But there's no way to predict year in and year out who's going to be what, right? So
that's fair.
The Wisconsin game is – that's, I don't know why people are discounting that, like it's not a good win. It's a neutral floor. Not that everyone is discounting it, but they should have been able to play Butler, but Butler lost to a team that Virginia beat. So that's how stuff works. Also, when you get into these bigger tournaments – like a Battle for Atlantis, that's not the Corpus Christi Classic. The expectation is that you're going to play tougher teams. So you might not schedule as tough of teams outside of that as you maybe would have had like a Villanova or West Virginia before. So that argument, that rant is mostly for the folks that think that Virginia looks bad for scheduling week or that they're not trying or like this is embarrassing for a top 10. Like that's not how this stuff works. Like they just schedule teams that are, they scheduled South Carolina coming off of Final Four. Towson fell off the face of the earth. GW fell off the face of the earth as far as Ken Pom rankings go. So anyway, I'm not too concerned. They'll have plenty of time to either show that they're ready or pick up big wins when they play difficult ACC conference.
They've got three top 10, as of right now, three top 10 games in the first month of the season.
Yeah.
Plus, including one of them being a road trip.
Yeah.
God, the first month of ACC play, you've got road trip to number one Duke, road trip to number 20 NC State, plus road trips to Notre Dame and Clemson in there. Yeah. And then home top 10 matchups against Florida State and Virginia Tech. So we'll find out whether this team's a paper tiger or not.
Yeah.
We'll find out pretty quick.
I think the other thing that I find interesting about a lot of the hand-wringing is there were no games. Like, Michigan is rightfully being praised as one of the best teams in the country, right? They have struggled with some of the not as good teams at various points in their games, right? So, like, struggled in the sense that either they were losing to Western Michigan in the second half. They didn't have a huge lead on Air Force going into the second half. Like, not anything where maybe Michigan fans were concerned they were going to blow it, but, like,
they were.
They've had that's true. But, like, Western Michigan's like 209. South Carolina, which I think most people think Virginia handled with relative ease. There were a couple points where, again, South Carolina got close. But, you know, like, Virginia was on the road, Michigan was at home and struggled with South Carolina at times, right? Virginia hasn't done that. So in their defense with this scheduling debate, is the games that they were supposed to win, they handily won, right? Like, there were no doubts about the Towsons and the Middle Tennessee States and the Morgan States and even VCU, which was a tight, like, Commonwealth matchup type thing. They handled it. So that's where I'm kind of like, and then games like Maryland, when before people were concerned, can Virginia outscore anyone? They finally do, and everyone's still like, well, they let Maryland come back in it. And I was like, all right, well, you know what? Here we are. Yeah. Anyway, so last game of the season. Sorry. Non-conference. Last game of the season. That's it, guys. As we close out 2018, they play on New Year's Eve's day. There you go. 1 p.m. game on New Year's Eve. So it's technically, anyway, against Marshall.
Like what is that, like New Year's in India?
Yes, exactly. I think that's it. They're playing it to celebrate New Year's celebration in India. Yeah,
exactly.
Against Marshall, which is a very fast-paced John Elmore. I was going to say Len Elmore because, you know, ACC. Anyway, so we've got a bunch of stuff going on coming up. We've got bowl game on Saturday, basketball on the 31st, and thanks for listening. Stay with streakingthelawn.com for all your updates, and on behalf of Paul and myself, happy holidays, and go Hoos!